It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, we'll look back at the career of legendary Arizona legislator Burton Barr. He's the subject of a new book by ASU professor Philip Vandermeer. And we'll find out why the legislature hasn't had anyone like Barr since he left the Capitol nearly 30 years ago. Plus, how should water policy change to keep the Colorado River from going dry? I'll talk with expert Sandra Postel, and we'll learn about traveling and exploring underwater with National Geographic explorers David Dubilet and Jennifer Hayes. We start today's program with news from the general election, which we think happened more than a week ago, but the race in Arizona's 2nd Congressional District has been so close, it hasn't officially been called yet. Joining us with the latest is Tucson Weekly's Jim Ninsel, who's also the host and producer of the TV program in Southern Arizona, Zona Politics. Good morning, Nins.
Good morning.
So where does the vote count stand officially, and are you surprised it is so, I don't think I've heard the phrase razor thin as many times as I have in the last week to describe this race.
Yes, razor thin indeed. It stands at 133 votes with virtually all the ballots counted here in both Pima County and Cochise County. I am a little surprised to see a race come this close. I don't know that we've ever had a congressional election in the state this close. I'm not aware of one. And I know that Politico was calling this one of the most suspenseful House races in the country a week before the election, and that has certainly proved to be true here. And, you know, this was a race that was the candidate, a rematch of 2012 when Martha McSally first challenged Ron Barber, and she lost by about 2,500 votes in that particular race. So it's much closer this year. And we'll see if Team Barber can pull out a miracle. They have some thoughts that there were some provisional ballots in Pima County that were rejected by the county recorder's office, and they may start challenging those ballots to see if those can be brought back in and requalified from the disqualification that they had earlier.
Right. That's what came to mind for me when you said virtually all of the ballots, because for the last couple of days we've been sort of counting down as we get it closer and closer to zero. But if we talk about those potential provisional ballots, would there be enough to potentially turn it back toward Barber's way, even if we may be headed for a recount in either case?
That's, I think, the question of the day, and one we really won't know. There's about 782 provisional ballots that were rejected by the county recorder's office, and we don't know the grounds for that disqualification at this point. So we'd have to go through. These are ballots of people who were perhaps mailed an early ballot and then showed up at the polling place to cast a ballot because they lost their early ballot, or people who were voting in the wrong precinct or some other hiccup on election day. For happens in every election with a handful of voters, and in this case we don't know how many of these ballots were even in Congressional District 2. It's 782 countywide. So I imagine what we're looking at next is we're going to see some legal action on this. And there are another 200 ballots or so that are called conditional provisional ballots, and those are ballots where voters have to show up by 5 p.m. today to confirm that they have the proper ID and are properly eligible to vote. And we'll see how many of those get back into the mix. But at this point, there are so few ballots left that it's going to take a lot for Ron Barber to overcome that 133-vote margin.
And it's from what you know, is it likely there is going to be a recount based on just how close it is?
Yeah, the rules are if it's less than 200 votes, there is a recount, and that certainly seems to be where we're at now. I'm not entirely clear on the process of a recount, but evidently it takes place in December, so we've got a few weeks to see what happens between now and then. And I believe that first they do a hand count of certain precincts to see if those come out right. And if that's on the money, then and matches what the machines came up with, they do not go forward with the full recount, according to Mark Evans, who is a Pima County spokesperson down here. But on the other hand, there was some very strange ballot issues in Cochise County, which is an area of the district where Martha McSally did really well. They had a snafu with the vote counting machines there, and the ballots actually had to be airlifted by helicopter over to Graham County to be counted on their machine. Yeah. And, you know, quite often when you run ballots through a machine a second time, you get an second, you get a different result. So there's still a lot of suspense in this race.
Analyze this district for us, Nance. What does this say about the district and its voters when something is this close? Which party has the registration advantage down there?
Republican Party has a slight registration advantage of 3 or 4 points, I think, but it's almost split one-third Democrat, one-third Republican, and one-third Independent. So seeing this sort of close race 2 years in a row, and actually several cycles in a row. I mean, Gabby Giffords barely beat Jesse Kelly in this district in 2010. So, and of course, there's been some redistricting since then. But this has been a district where there's been several narrow contests in the last several cycles. And I expect to see the same thing going forward because you do have a very serious split between the Libs and the Conservatives down here.
So how would that affect whichever candidate ultimately wins? Does that person, regardless of what the party may tell them in Washington, does that person have to ultimately play to the middle?
Well, that's a really great question. And I think, in general, the candidate will have to play to the middle. You saw that with Ron Barber. He's considered one of the most independent members of Congress because he would move towards the Republicans, vote alongside the Republicans on issues regarding the border or issues regarding health care, the Obamacare, Affordable Care Act. So you already saw that happening with Ron Barber. I suspect you'd see that with Martha McSally. She has a more difficult situation because I believe in Republican primaries, they're a little more brutal than in Democratic primaries about towing the party line. So she's always going to have to be looking at her right flank and when she takes those votes, but she's also going to have to be looking towards the general election. And that's a very challenging environment to be in.
And then finally, what's the public reaction to this so far? Is there a buzz around the area? Is there talk about, boy, it would have been great if there'd been bigger turnout, that kind of thing?
Well, I think the Barber campaign would have loved to see larger turnout because they think that would have favored them, particularly when you look around the country and see its election results with Republicans dominating everywhere, it seems, in the country, except for, you know, Congressional District 1 here in Arizona, where Ann Kirkpatrick was able to withstand a challenge. But I imagine there's a lot of talk about this race, a lot of people buzzing about, you know, should they go to court, should they not go to court, who's going to come out in the end, will there be a recount? A lot of excitement about this one.
Tucson Weekly's Jim Nensley is also the host and producer of the new TV program in Southern Arizona, Zona Politics. Jim, thanks.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. President Barack Obama continues to say he'll take executive action to limit deportations of undocumented immigrants as part of his effort to reform the U.S. immigration system. But with the results of last week's election putting Republicans in charge of the House and Senate, many political leaders are warning the president against acting, believing it could hurt the chances of more comprehensive reform. Tomorrow afternoon in the Valley, a protest will be held in front of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office in Phoenix, calling for the president to act. With me for a few minutes is Francisca Porchas, an organizer with Puente, Arizona. Francisca, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So what do you want President Obama to do, and when do you want him to do it?
Well, we wanted him to do it a long time ago, but we say today is a good day, tomorrow, the day after. We want him to stop delaying the executive action that he promised he would do by the summer. Which then he delayed to Thanksgiving, which now we're waiting on. He delayed post-elections because there was a group of senators who were very worried about losing the elections. So he was catering to them and has had us waiting for executive action for relief for potentially about 6 million people. We want relief for everybody. We think everybody needs it, but we know it's very possible he's only going to give relief to less than half of the people that are undocumented right now.
Are you concerned that it appears that he's sort of pandering to one side then sort of pandering to the other? Would you have been happier if he had sort of been quiet and then just taken the action as opposed to telling people he's going to and then disappointing a lot of people by not doing it?
I would have been happier if he would have done it probably last year or the year before. I think that, unfortunately, he miscalculated politically. He was worried that the elections were going to be taken by the Republicans. It was very clear the Republicans were going to take the Senate anyway, and I think that for a long time this action has been needed. And so I think it was a very big political miscalculation that cost him a lot and that cost the party a lot. I think we've known that there was very low Latino turnout, and maybe there would have been a lot more Latinos that would have gone out and voted and felt inspired to do so if he had taken action before.
And then other people would say the chicken and the egg there, that maybe if more Latinos had voted, then he would have felt more inclined and more empowered to act.
Well, the reality is that our people have felt disempowered to vote for a long time. Obama has been in power for 6 years, and he's made promises even before he got elected for something to happen. So this has been long overdue. Beyond the delay that happened during the summer, this has been very long overdue. So it's a problem that wasn't just about this election, but it's a promise that's been broken for a long time for Latinos in general.
If he acts to limit deportations, do you think that limits the chances for comprehensive reform? Would you rather there be just an effort of comprehensive reform and to not worry about a step-by-step approach?
No. We think that the bleeding needs to stop. We have 34,000 people that are now stuck in detention across the country. There's a bed quota that all detention centers have to be a 34,000 person capacity. We have 1,000 people being deported every day. The human suffering is a very big deal for our people. Families are being separated, destroyed. We need the relief now. We've needed it for a long time, and I don't necessarily think that that determines or doesn't determine a future immigration reform. What I know is that we can't keep waiting as people are being deported every day. We have a mother right now who's in detention. She has 4 children that have been suffering. She's been in detention for 10 months. 4 children are waiting on her, don't have a stable home. She's the only parent, and she could be deported if he doesn't act as soon as possible. Because she could qualify for whatever he puts forth, as thousands and thousands of people and millions of people across the country like her.
Francisca, there'll be a group tomorrow afternoon in front of the Phoenix Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office. What's the message going to be? How many people do you hope will turn out?
We're hoping for at least 100 people. It's going to be a speak out as well. We're going to have clergy, reverends, rabbis. We're going to have different community organizations. There's a big fight for $15 here in fast food industry. We're going to have speakers from there and members. We're going to have dreamers. We're going to have our own community. We're going to have the family of this woman. Her name is Norma Bernal Gutierrez, who's in detention, speaking out. We're going to profile her case, as there are many cases like Norma's that could benefit right now from the president's action. And so we're going to be speaking out, sending a strong message. We want to continue putting this on the map. His delays are unacceptable, and we want to send a strong message that he needs that.
Francisca Porchas is an organizer with Puente, Arizona. Francisca, thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll look back at the career of legendary Arizona legislator Burton Barr and find out why there aren't more like him in the current legislature. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Delta Dental of Arizona. Research shows there's a strong connection between a healthy mouth and overall health. Regular dental checkups are an important part of that mouth-body connection. More information at deltadentalaz.com.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. Checking Valley traffic right now on I-10 eastbound. Watch out for a crash blocking the shoulder at Warner Road. And on the Pima portion of the Loop 101, the westbound exit ramp at 19th Avenue is still blocked by a crash. Around the state right now, sunny and 51 degrees up at the Grand Canyon. It's 51 as well in Flagstaff, 60 in Prescott, sunny and 73 in Tucson, 73 degrees as well in Yuma. Are you planning a fall road trip? If you have a vehicle that won't be part of your trip to Santa Fe or Rocky Point, why not donate it to KJZZ? You can find out more at cars.kjzz.org, and thanks. Mostly sunny skies, and it's 73 degrees right now in Phoenix at 1121.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. since 1987, or at least over the past decade. Some Arizona legislative watchers will at some point mention how much the state misses the leadership and big-picture bipartisanship practiced by Burton Barr. Many Phoenicians only know Barr because his name is on the city's main library, but they don't actually know why it's there. Others remember him for crossing the aisle to work with legislative Democrats like Alfredo Gutierrez and Art Hamilton and Governor Bruce Babbitt. Barr was also the shoo-in gubernatorial nominee in 1986, who inexplicably lost to Evan Meekum. All of those stories and more are part of the new work, Burton Barr, Leadership and the Transformation of Arizona Politics, by ASU professor Philip Vandermeer.
John Colby said, who is the columnist for the Phoenix Gazette, he said Burton Barr wrote the legislative history of the state for 20 years, and that's dead on. Barr was really quite an extraordinary legislative leader. He purposely identified key issues, the important issues, and he went after them. He revised the tax system. He was very directly involved in that. He was very concerned about health care, so the access program is really his, but a whole variety of other things. He was concerned about levels of educational funding, and so he worked on those sorts of things. He wasn't a policy wonk in that sense. He wasn't somebody who was up to all hours looking at fine details. His degree of knowledge varied. The Groundwater Management Act in 1980, which is a hugely important measure. This is really Bruce Babbitt's project in that he negotiated the specifics. But Burton Barr, who was a co-chair of the committee that set this up, framed the politics and the legislative response to this in such a way that the law, that the proposal is actually enacted. So his responsibility varied depending on the kind of subject. But everything, I would say virtually everything that's important that gets done over 20 years has Barr's fingerprints in it.
Well, in this time where it seems like things are even more partisan than they were in past years, how is it that Barr was able to stay this leader, use this power in such a way?
He understood, as a number of other people did in the 1960s, that the state had urbanized and developed economically, and that the legislature, in fact, the government, had utterly failed to respond to the needs of this new kind of society. So when you have court-mandated redistricting, you have a complete change in representation and in party control. And so Barr, along with Bill Jaquin and Sandra Day O'Connor and some others, pushed forward to modernize government. Mm-hmm. And it's also true that the parties looked different than they do now. Republicans included moderates and modernizers. The Democratic Party included the so-called Pinto Democrats, conservative rural Democrats. So a final thing is that generally through this the period of Barr's being in office, the parties were relatively close in the legislature. So Barr is particularly working with both sides because of political necessity, but also it was his own instinct.
Barr's personality, what was it like, and how did that fit into how he got things done?
Hugely important. Barr is one of those people, the Reader's Digest used to, I don't know if they anymore do this, ran a series called My Most Unforgettable Character. Barr would have been that for dozens of people. He was an extraordinary character. He was engaging. He was funny. He had a raft of stories, but he listened. He paid attention. He cared about people. He had a terrific memory. And all of this was very important. It was important as people saw him personally, and he used those traits, those characteristics, as he worked with legislators. So he knew who they were, and he knew their families, and he knew their kids, and he knew what they wanted to do, and that was who he was. But it was, of course, also hugely important as he tried to get things done in the legislature.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with ASU professor Philip Vandermeer. His new book is about the former legislative leader of Arizona, Burton Barr, and it hits bookshelves this week. Professor, what about the fact that I mentioned earlier Art Hamilton, Alfredo Gutierrez, and I'm thinking about Arizona in the 70s, and I'm wondering if, was it a big deal that Burton Barr had great relationships with these non-Anglo Democrats?
I think it's notable. I think, frankly, what's more notable is what this reflects about his sense of leadership. He is involved not just in transactional leadership, not just in doing deals. He's also very significant as a mentor. So Alfredo Gutierrez comes in, looks around, recognizes that Barr is very influential and knowledgeable, and he talks to him. Even more striking is that Barr himself observes Art Hamilton and calls him into his office and chats with him and says, ultimately, he says, listen, there are a variety of options for you. If you want to make sort of incendiary speeches and so forth, that's fine. But if you want to learn how to be a legislator and make this place work, I'll teach you. And so literally he taught him. Art Hamilton followed him along, talked to him. They became extremely close friends, Barr and Hamilton and Barr and Gutierrez.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people might think of Barr because of that infamous loss to Evan Meekum in the 1986 gubernatorial primary, which a lot of people thought was just going to be Barr's to coast to, and Meekum had been this gadfly at that time who'd been around for so many years. Did Barr express regrets about that? Did he express what happened, why the campaign didn't go any better? And did he ever have any guilt about sort of being the one who lost to Evan Meekum, who ultimately then beat two Democrats as well?
Yes, he did. He felt certainly embarrassed by the loss. He reflected a few days after the loss in an interview, his sadness that he had let people down. This, of course, became even more a concern as time developed and as Meekum demonstrated more and more the kind of problem character that he was. The loss was really traumatic. It took him some time, really, to get over this. And for someone who was ordinarily so positive and cheerful, this was just a stunning loss. And he recognized that he had been one of the problems for the campaign.
Now, of course, term limits didn't exist then. So why did Barr decide to leave the legislature?
There are a variety of reasons. I think, for one thing, the legislature itself was changing. There was more of an edge to some of the conservatives. He had been the leader for 20 years. Some of these people had heard his stories and jokes, and so some of that was less effective. I think to a certain extent, he had also really done what he meant to do, what he came to do. He came into office with a vision of transforming state government and making it modern and efficient and bringing about policies that would respond to all of the state's needs. It's not that there were no problems after that and no issues, but I think he felt that he really had dealt with things that he needed to. It was also not incidental that many people were retiring. Stan Turley, Alfredo Gutierrez, Bruce Babbitt was leaving. He really thought maybe there was a time for new challenges. And then, of course, what really tipped him over was President Reagan's request that he run for the nomination.
Philip Vandermeer, the author of Burton Barr, Leadership and the Transformation of Arizona Politics. A public event to launch the book will be held tomorrow night at, not coincidentally, the Burton Barr Library in downtown Phoenix. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. Now we're going to talk about what it was like to work with Burton Barr in the legislature and what would make Barr such an anomaly now. We'll start with former state legislative leader Chris Hurston, who served as a Republican with Barr for 4 years. Also with us is Democratic State Senator Steve Farley, who will be assistant minority leader when the next legislative session begins in January. He joins us from the studios of Arizona Public Media in Tucson. Welcome to you both. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for
having
me.
Great. Glad to be here.
So, Chris, what was it like to work with Barr? How did he lead that may be different from the leaders we're seeing now?
Well, I had the privilege of being a very young freshman legislator in 1983, and so in the House. And so I got to serve with Burt Barr his last 4 years. And then I served another 4 years before retiring without Burt Barr. So I got to see that tremendous contrast. Getting to know Burt Barr was the greatest experience, political experience of my life. He was really a very average-looking person, not a CEO type. He was a small businessman, but there was a persona about him. He was friendly. He was enthusiastic. He was optimistic. And you knew that he only cared about one thing, and that was the future of this state and solving problems. And he truly was demonstrated something that we just don't see often today, and that was he provided tremendous leadership from the center. Ideologues were his enemies, in a sense, because they wouldn't compromise and he couldn't get votes that way. And so he constantly went after the center of both political parties and worked very closely with centrist governors, Republican and Democrat, and produced solutions for the major problems of the day at the state capitol.
Senator Steve Farley, you are in the trenches now and have been for a while. Is it as clear inside that we're lacking that, or are there people and experiences we don't hear about enough? Or is it as tough as we tend to hear?
It is tough. We have had our successes. I don't want to overlook the Medicaid expansion battle, in which case there were clear leaders on both sides of the aisle who came together. But those leaders were not in leadership. That's the really important distinction here. Our leaders who are currently in leadership in the House and the Senate are leaders who don't want to modernize government, as the professor said earlier that Burt Barr wanted to do. They would rather minimize government. They would rather cut government down to the size where it can be drowned in the bathtub, according to Grover Norquist's infamous words. And that's a real shame, because actually, when it comes down to it, our government does have the obligation to do the best it can in order to unleash our economy here in Arizona, to make sure our education system can provide for a basis for that. And the current leadership and the majorities in both houses are sadly not even trying to do that.
Right. We hear so much about the budget shortfall. Is that obviously that's reality, but is that used as an excuse too often?
It's used as a huge excuse, because the budget shortfall was created intentionally by the policies of this majority, in which they've decided to follow some of the national trends and just continue to give away our revenues in the form of large corporate tax cuts. And that's been something that's gone along throughout the entire country as sort of an ideological talking point. We haven't seen any data whatsoever that shows that giving away those types of tax cuts has helped us create any jobs or raise any wages or bring any businesses here. But what it has done is create a huge hole in the budget, which is meaning that we can't fund our schools at this point, because the decision was made while they cut $300 million a year from our schools against the law, according to the court order that's gone through. Mm-hmm. They were at the same time giving away $300 million a year minimum in these corporate tax giveaways.
Chris, how much is the situation set up by the fact that in this state, we're dominated by Republicans in the legislature, other states are dominated by Democrats? When you're dominated by one party, does it make it less likely that there will be compromise? Or is that, again, something that may just go depending on what year it is?
Well, sure, it absolutely. If you've got the numbers, if one political party has the numbers, and if the governor is of the same party, they can run the table. They can get the job done without reaching out to the other party. You know, Steve, with regards to Burt Barr, I think something that has not been properly analyzed, really, is when Burt Barr lost to Evan Meekum, and when he departed the legislature, you really lost the bright, shining example of the center of the Republican Party and its ability to move to the center and work with the other party and solve problems. And when Barr lost, that really was the first major example of the right wing part of the Republican Party having success. They upset this centrist, pragmatic, leading Republican and had a taste of victory. And then when there was the Evan Meekum impeachment because of illegalities from Governor Meekum, when there was the impeachment and the conviction and the ousting of Evan Meekum, that drove a wedge into the Republican Party that changed it forever. And once again, it was the moderates, the pragmatics, the centrists versus the more conservative ideologue types of the party. And slowly but surely over the decades since, the pragmatists and the moderates have been defeated in Republican low turnout, basically Republican primaries. I don't think the Republican Party in the state of Arizona has ever been the same since Burton Barr left the legislature and, more importantly, since he was defeated by Ev Meekum.
Hmm, interesting. Now, Steve Farley, when you head to back for the official legislative session opening in January, one thing I've noticed is that as the parties have chosen their leaders for the House and Senate, it had appeared, at least if we're going to lump people into either conservative or moderate, the Senate leadership on the Republican side had a couple of people who were considered moderates to the extent. John McComish, Adam Driggs. McComish has left office. Driggs is not going to be in leadership. Does that send a message to you?
It does, and I was going to bring up John McComish's name as well, because when the professor was talking about how Burt Barr was a mentor to Art Hamilton, I think John McComish was similarly my mentor.
Hmm.
And I greatly appreciated there were some things we were working on. I would go into his office and ask him strategy. He gave me some suggestions, and we worked on a lot of things behind the scenes as well as in front of the scenes when it came to the Medicaid expansion. And I really, really miss him being in that body, because I think that's exactly the sort of person we need to have more of. And I think there are fewer of them now based on people leaving. And in fact, Mr. McComish left because he really felt like trying for re-election would have been a tough fight against Mr. Morrissey, who was the head of the conservative wing of the state Republican Party. And he just didn't want to do that again. He just felt like it was going to get too dirty, because things really, as we've seen in this election, have been very, very difficult for people to be their own people as candidates, particularly as moderate Republicans, mm-hmm. because there's so much pressure from the national parties, from the big dark money nationally, to be fairly extreme in these issues. And I think that's very disappointing. So we will end up with a more conservative legislature on the Republican side. There still are some people that are fairly moderate that I'm planning to work with, and I think given the unity of the Senate Democratic Caucus now, together with the four remaining moderates in the Senate, I think we will be able to stop some egregious things. If they try to bring back 1062, I think we're going to be able to stop that in the Senate because the business community is still solidly against that. So as we come up with issues that the business community is in favor or against that Democrats also are in step with, I think we will be able to use the remaining moderates, their talent and their power to be able to stop things or potentially get some good things passed.
And Chris Hurston, final question for you. I'm going to frame this as pragmatic and pragmatism as opposed to moderate. You talked about how in some ways more the conservative Republicans saw more confidence rise after Burt Barr was defeated in the race for governor. As we look forward and we look ahead, are there moderates in the House or Senate, or people we'd label pragmatists in the House or Senate, who can take a leadership post, can do that, whether it's a leadership actual position or they're trying to be leaders, or have the parties changed so much? Has the system changed? Of course, we've talked about clean elections in the past and that kind of thing. Is the system just not set up to let someone push forward because that person will never get enough votes to actually be a leader?
I believe, unfortunately, it's the latter. There are some talented, what you would call, you named them, Republican pragmatists, people like Heather Carter and Kate Brophy McGee in the House come to mind, and Steve Pierce and Bob Worsley, Jeff Dial, Adam Driggs come to mind in the Senate, but they're outnumbered. The Republican Party is very, very conservative these days, and perhaps forever in our lifetimes. And so they don't have the numbers. The conservatives in the party, in the Republican caucuses, outnumber the pragmatists, and therefore those folks rising to power into leadership positions, I don't think is in the cards.
Steve Farley, final thought from you. Doug Ducey taking over as governor. Do you expect him to be someone who will be unpredictable and might veto some things that might surprise some in the legislature, or do you expect him to be something else? Or are you open-minded at this point?
I'm actually very optimistic about a Ducey governorship. He and I were both Toll Fellows at a national leadership training thing we went to in Kentucky a few years ago, and we talked a lot about our mutual desire to put aside ideology and do what's best for our constituents regardless of party. And I called him up to congratulate him the day after the election. He took my call. I was surprised. He has a lot of other things to do on that day. And we had a good talk about recommitting to that. And then he called me to congratulate me about being assistant minority leader, and we continued that talk. So I think elections have a tendency to make us more polarized than we are. And ultimately, he is a pragmatic, business-oriented person. And that's the sort of person I think that I can do business with as a legislator, as a Democrat. So I think that we will see some surprises if there are people who think that he's just someone following Kathy Herod or somebody who's going to be following Andy Biggs or David Gowan. I think he's going to be his own man, and I think we're going to see some reasonable, moderate policies come out of the governor's office, and I'll be talking with him quite a lot. He said he welcomes that.
Democratic State Senator Steve Farley, who joined us from the studios of Arizona Public Media in Tucson, also former state legislative leader Chris Hurstam. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about water policy and how that might affect the Colorado River. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Banner MD Anderson Cancer Center, walking hand in hand with patients and lighting a path of hope along their cancer journey. More information at BannerMDAndersonCancerCenter.com.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on your community news station, KJZZ. Should be a partly to mostly sunny day in the valley today. We're expecting a high of 81 degrees. Stay with us at 12 o'clock for NPR's Here and Now. We'll hear about today's start of the lame duck Congress, and 18,000 nurses are striking against Kaiser Permanente in California. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon on KJZZ. Mostly sunny skies right now in the valley, and it's 73 degrees at 11:43.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. The combination of living in the desert and the recent drought leads to a lot of thinking here in the valley about the condition of our water supply. Through the Change of the Course program and other ideas, water policy expert Sandra Postel is working to help restore water to depleted rivers and wetlands, including the Colorado River, which provides water to Arizona and six other states. Postel says momentum is growing for conservation and increasing water efficiency.
You know, we've just come off of a century of building big dams and diversions and, you know, doing what we call water development, bringing water to, you know, to the farms and cities where people are and where farmers are. And that's really helped build the West. I mean, that's been a very positive thing for growing the West. But now we're finding, you know, as we begin to run into limits, you know, hitting limits of the water supply, we're finding that conservation and wiser use of water is much more than just a response to drought. It's really a long-term strategy that can meet our future water needs just as effectively, in fact, more effectively than some of these big engineering projects have done, because they're less dependent on, you know, sort of the distant water supplies that are going to become less reliable, particularly as climate change comes along. So I think conservation and efficiency as a long-term strategy of building water security and water resilience is really, I think, the name of the game.
What are some factors in terms of being more efficient and in terms of conservation that can actually restore water and make it so it isn't just we're counting down and we're hoping against hope that, for example, in Arizona, that we get a better snowpack, which then lets the water run down and replenish? What are some things we can do without relying so much on breaking the drought or dealing with climate change? Things that we can actually do, not just individuals, but in terms of a real concerted effort by our leaders in whatever field they may or may not be in?
It's a good question, and there's a lot we can do. That's really, to me, the silver lining in this whole picture, is that we've just barely begun to scratch the surface of the potential of conservation and efficient use and wiser management. And just one, you know, one obvious example is so much of our water use in the West in our homes is used in our landscapes right outside. And in many cases, 50 to 60% of our household water use is water used outdoors. And so there's a lot of potential to put in place more native landscaping, more vegetation that's appropriate to the climate, that doesn't need as much irrigation water. And we can bring household water use way down when we do that. I've been struck by the announcement by the mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, last month, you know, stating that, you know, he's issuing a directive to work toward cutting Los Angeles imports of water in half by 2020. And much of that's going to happen by using local water supplies much more effectively, pulling out the stops on conservation, especially outdoor water use, and getting more efficient with that. But then using stormwater more effectively, recharging groundwater with it, capturing it and using it more in place. So these green infrastructure types of solutions are really ways of repairing the urban water cycle that can reduce our need for water imports and use that supply much more efficiently and build resilience at the same time, and frankly, more beautiful cities at the same time. We're seeing cities, not only Los Angeles, but Philadelphia beginning to do this, and a number of other cities realizing there's a lot of, you know, sort of bang for the buck to come from those kinds of solutions.
Sandra, to those of us who live in the Southwest, and especially in the deserts of the Southwest, take water for granted, thinking that, well, it's amazing that the water is even here, so that must be a good sign for all of us.
Yeah, you know, I think our water suppliers have done a fantastic job. You know, if you think about the West and the way it was a century ago, how much lower population, how fewer farms, and, you know, the West, the water suppliers have done an amazing job taking a fairly limited and you know, obviously finite resource and bringing it to where it's been needed and desired and demanded for food production and growing, you know, major metropolitan areas from Phoenix and L.A. to Las Vegas and Tucson. So this, I think, the hats off, you know, to that strategy. But I think we're starting to see the need for a new day. And, again, our water suppliers are beginning to see this, too, that, you know, that it, we're going to have to sort of make a real mindset shift away from going out and finding water whenever we need more and realizing there's a whole lot more we can do by using what we have.
So, Sandra, tell us about Change the Course.
Well, Change the Course is a new approach to water conservation and restoration, and it's being pioneered by a partnership of three interesting entities. One is National Geographic, and I work with National Geographic as their Freshwater Fellow. Another is the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, which has pioneered some very interesting water policy tools in the West. And then Participant Media, the film company, which actually has very extensive experience in social action campaigns around these important types of issues. So the three of us are pioneering this model called Change the Course, which works to engage the public in understanding what their own personal water footprint is, not just the water used at home, but the water that's embedded in our diets and in our use of energy. You know, it takes 13 gallons of water to make a gallon of gasoline. And in the clothes that we wear, you know, the shirt I'm wearing right now probably took 700 gallons of water to make. So raising awareness about the water footprint that each of us has and offering tools for understanding that. But then we ask, you know, make a pledge to do something in your life. And it's not a pledge of money, but a pledge to conserve. And we promise for every pledge that's made that we'll return 1,000 gallons of water to a depleted part of the Colorado River Basin, headwaters all the way down to the Delta. So at this point, we've been able to restore more than 2.8 billion gallons of water, again, from headwater rivers all the way down to the Delta. And 1 billion of those are in the Delta in Mexico, where a very historic restoration is underway of the habitats of this, what once was really one of the great desert aquatic ecosystems. So it's a fabulous model, and it's working, and we're piloting it in the Colorado River Basin because it's such an important river basin, you know, hugely under stress. And we figured this is a great pilot because it's a river basin every American and many people in the world can relate to. But now we're sort of getting ready as well to see, well, this is what we need to build a new water stewardship campaign for the world. And so we're beginning to think about moving it out and moving it elsewhere so others can get engaged as well.
Water policy expert Sandra Postel. She'll be in Tempe for 3 days beginning on Sunday for a residency at Barrett, the Honors College at ASU. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We go from trying to make sure there's enough water in the Colorado River to undersea exploration. Tonight at the Mesa Arts Center, the National Geographic Speakers Series continues with underwater photographer David Duboulay and aquatic biologist and photojournalist Jennifer Hayes, who joined me in studio. Their presentation is called Coral, Fire, and Ice, Exploring Secret Underwater Worlds. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David, what attracted you to the water?
I was a small child growing up in the distant planet called New Jersey. And for water and going underwater was a great escape. Because once you put your head underwater, as Jacques Cousteau once said in The Silent World, his famous book, civilization vanishes with one last bow. And for a little kid with asthma, I was in a world that I could swim, I could glide, I could fly, I could breathe. It was wonderful.
So were you focused, even at a young age, thinking this is something I want to be able to do for the rest of my life?
I think from the first time I put my head underwater, which is strange, not in New Jersey, but in a little summer camp in the Adirondacks, not far from where Jennifer and I live now, when I put my head underwater, I knew then. I was 8 or 9 years old.
And Jennifer, what about you?
Well, I came to it differently. I grew up on a dairy farm, about as far from the ocean. Well, I could have lived in the Midwest, I would have been farther. But upstate New York, we had a dairy farm, and we had a pond, and I was always in it, under it. And my dad would say, all right, chores, you have chores. But I was always, we lived close to Lake Ontario, and I was just fascinated by everything. Fish, turtles, frogs, you name it. A little obsessed, probably over-obsessed. But I just became fascinated. That led to biology. That led to more fish and more underwater and more research, which led to needing pictures to take and show at symposiums, which led to photography. So I came to it differently.
But the remarkable things the two of you have seen is so different from wanting to get underwater in New Jersey to escape asthma or studying it. I wonder how the next steps was, were there expectations you'd be able to take these steps? Because I would think even a young kid who loved the water wasn't thinking he'd be taking the amazing photographs you've taken.
You know, it's funny. The one thing about going underwater is that you do have a desire, a job, and a responsibility, and that's to bring back these feelings and what you see. And the way to do that, obviously, is through photography. And for me, photography came at about the same time as this great interest in diving and being underwater. So it all sort of came together in this one instant moment. And it was always it's always been a battle to make pictures underwater as far as technique goes, as far as vision goes.
Jennifer, as far as the mysteries of the water, because I think people think about that the first time they go in. I mean, I was someone who loved to swim at an early age, but growing up in this area, we had a pool. And I remember the first time I saw the movie Jaws, I was afraid there'd be a shark in the pool, which of course makes no sense. Were the mysteries of the water ever scary to you?
No. Yes.
Maybe?
More curious. I think I'm curious. I think growing up on the farm put me in proximity to a lot of situations and animals and a lot of surprises. Oh, that won't bite. Ouch, it bit. You just get used to... You get used to something and just expect the unexpected. Mm-hmm. And being around a lot of animals all your life and riding with a vet and studying zoology and then going underwater, it just expanded the universe into a wet universe. More creatures, more unexpectedness. I'm more curious than I am afraid. And I'm waiting and watching and saying, what will that do? What will it do? It does nothing. And then all of a sudden, it does something so extraordinary, you're like, did I just see that? And there's not time, you're kind of always hoping for extraordinary. Right. And then you kind of sense when the extraordinary becomes maybe too extraordinary and you should get out of the water. And you sense that. You say, okay, I don't have control here. And maybe it's time to leave. Like you might be working with a shark that all of a sudden changes his posture or more than one shark shows up or something. And you realize... Some sense in you says, okay, I'm not in control of the situation.
But how long did it take you to learn that, to know when the moment might strike where it's not a good moment for you?
You just sense it. Mm. David and I were together, and we'll look at each other at about the same time. It's a human condition that you say, maybe maybe this will lead to a lot of paperwork if we stay in the water, and it's time to get out. You just sense it. I think it even, who knows, maybe it's primal. It could be that simple. I don't know. But something tells you, if you stay, you could get a heck of a photo, but at a very, very big price. And sometimes you push beyond that, and you carry home that photo and think, well, that was stupid. But at the same time, you draw lines sometimes. You're not out there not to come home. You're out there to see it, feel it, experience, breathe it, smell it, photograph it, but come home and share it. And you take it right up to the edge sometimes.
And David, how much preparation goes into it, and how has preparation changed the longer you've done this, where you've got the valuable experience, so you have more of an idea of what to expect? But if you're the next trip is... The next one you're taking is in...
We'll be working, and it's a continuation of a story. We'll be working on a story on the Sargasso Sea. Okay. We're working in Bermuda, which is basically a ship anchored permanently in the edge of the Sargasso Sea. And we're working under these great mats of sargassum weed. It's like a golden forest upside down. It's beautiful, but it disappears from day to day, so it's very frustrating. That's our next trip. And so preparation counts for almost everything, but preparation always begins with some kind of dream, and it usually begins in the shower when I'm thinking of something.
At least it's in the water. So
yeah, the water, the falling water creates an ionization in the air, which releases brain waves. But we're always thinking of another idea, another image, and the image is a wonderful combination of new technology and dreams. And that's what photography, that's the challenge of photography. And the dreams are based very strongly on the reality and the science. And that's where Jennifer and I work together. That's how the partnership really works visually.
Hmm. Jennifer, one thing that struck me looking online, you have amazing photos of these harp seals in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. I wonder if you could describe a few of them. I know you took many, but a few that the two of you experienced. And I'm also struck by where trust comes in, where you can get so close to these creatures, and we talked about if a moment gets a little dangerous, but if it doesn't, how is it that there's this bond? How does that develop?
Well, trust goes both ways. You trust the animal not to devour you, and it trusts you not to invade its space. They tell you their territory. They give you the boundaries. For the harp seals, It's been one of our most extraordinary experiences photographing. It's actually been a life-changing experience. It's in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and we live on the St. Lawrence River, so technically it's our backyard, and it's a journey, but we still call it our home water. And we go out there in February on the ice, and we work both on the ice and under the ice. You suit up in a dry suit and big cameras, and you'll lay down with a mother or a pup, and get closer. And it may take you an hour to go 4 inches to get close to a mother and pup nursing. And then you still have another 4 feet to go. So you may be laying there all day and letting the mother roll back and forth and look at you. And then finally, at some point in the future, you're close to her and you're making this big wide-angle photograph. Mm. But it takes trust. She recognizes you as a threat at first, and then if you lay long enough, she says, well, it can't be all that bad. She's here for hours. And you just get closer. Underwater, it's a different story. It's dynamic. It's moving. You're cold. You're freezing. You can't stay there for hours. You're in pain. And the seals are whizzing.